You're listening to Wake Up Tucson. This podcast is a Bustos Media production on The Voice. Be sure to subscribe wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
Early landing. Early landing. Now, anything... So what Ryan Hartman's saying is anything that doesn't safely land where we intend it to is now an early landing. Is that what we're saying? So when if there's a plane that crashes and it before it gets to the airport it's supposed to get to, is that an early landing with fatalities? I just want to make sure Ryan's the expert. I mean, you can't get more sexy than Ryan Hartman right now. He looked great. The haircut, the glasses.
Let's say you run out of gas in your airplane and you land on a freeway.
Right, you do a Harrison Ford. Right? See, this is what Hartman should be doing is we just pulled the Harrison Ford. Now, of course, listening to... I don't even know why this story is necessary. Right? So the only reason this story is on... is because they complain to the news outlets, right? Right. That's the only reason this story is because the news outlets said it crashed. Well, it's certainly not a crash. It's an early landing. So there were two, when Matt and I were talking about this, there were two comedy skits that listening to Ryan, well, there's three really, right? Nothing to See Here, Please Disperse, right? Matt rightfully brought up Dan Aykroyd on old Saturday Night Live.
Broken bag of glass. It's fun. Broken bag of glass. Jane Curtin interviewing him 60 Minutes style. Sir, kids could get
about his unsafe, it's unsafe toys for the holidays, right? I thought of the dead parrot in Monty Python. The parrot's not dead, right?
Pining for the fjords.
Who knew I was going to hear Pining for the Fjords today? What other things can we have early landings for? So I want to do this. I want to take the worldview logic, okay, and I want to apply it to a crash, a historic crash in the old days. And of course, this is the Hindenburg. This is the Hindenburg tragedy. And I have the text from the news broadcast. I'm gonna see if I can. I want to replace the words of the worldview. And this is again PR wise. This is like I don't know what they hope to gain from this, right? Having a Friday night KOLD story that says this.
Are we invoking Lakehurst, New Jersey?
Here we go. Get this, Charlie. It's fire. It's early landing. I'm replacing early crashing with early landing. It's early landing. Terrible. Oh my, get out of the way, please. It's burning, bursting in the flames. Folks agree that this is terrible. This is one of the worst catastrophes in the world. It's the flames. Oh, 400 or 500 feet into the sky. It's a terrific early landing, ladies and gentlemen. It's smoke. It's flames. The frame is crashing. Early landing to the ground. I almost blew it. Not quite to the mooring mass. Oh, the humanity. All right, Ted Maxwell. There's a memo out from Mike Rankin, out to the council and crew and Ortega about some of the pitfalls of Prop 206. Where do you want to start with your executive summary?
Summary is going to kind of go through it. Now, I'll tell you right up front, one, I thought it was a very well-written document. He also went both opened and finished for anybody out there of concern with the reminder of the Arizona statute, Section 95-500-1.4, that talks about they can't use the city resource to influence the outcome of the election. This is not trying to influence in any way. It's written very professionally and detailed, factual oriented. It's not trying to influence the eyes of the decisions made by the voters. What I'm going to tell you is that what he points out in here is the reason the voters should be a no on this, because the $15 we've already kind of said. The state has a minimum wage that's going to be tracking very closely, depending on the CPI, maybe even faster than this initiative will move it to $15. The proponents will tell you it's not about the $15. The opponents will tell you, yeah, we've got problems with minimum wages in general, but it's not about the $15 in this one. This is about the back end. the 4.5 pages of the document that do not deal with the minimum wage. And it's what they're putting in there. And the problem is, several of those sections, as pointed out by the city attorney, are against either the Arizona Constitution or federal and state labor laws and wage laws. And it's going to cause problems that probably will be resolved in court, maybe, that are going to bring on a lot of costs to the city. And ultimately, as we pointed out in the first half of the show, who's going to really get hurt by this? It's going to be the people there and claiming they're intending to help. Those unskilled, those workers, the workers that need further training or education, those that are new to work, trying to establish a resume to try to work and learn, try to move forward, the ones they're trying to help.
Back to the cui bono, right? Who does this help, right? It helps chains in the end because this is such a hurt against a small business person. It doesn't help the worker because they're going to get smaller take-home paychecks. So they're going to have to work more hours to make it up to pay their bills. It helps the unions, I think, because a lot of their stuff pegs off a minimum wage of a certain municipality. I don't see, the best part is it doesn't help anybody that it's supposed to help.
It doesn't. It really doesn't. And it could hurt the city and the region. One of the first sections that the attorney addresses is the fact that the state legislature this year gave Flagstaff a $1.1 million bill. And that's to make up for the costs associated with their minimum wage, which is at 15 already, that are basically refunding the state the money they're required to put out because of it and the harm it's done. And he's very clear, it is working its way through the courts, but if the courts don't invalidate the authority of the state legislature, which I don't think they're going to make that assessment, 1.1 will be minuscule compared to what it's, if you base just on population alone, what it's going to cost the city of Tucson. That will be straight out of the general funds, straight out of doing the things the city needs to do to pay somewhere probably in the $4 to $5 million range, if not higher.
The latest hearing on the flag state one, that just happened or going to happen? I think it's like really imminent.
It's imminent. It's making its way through the courts on the way up. Ultimately, it'll probably end up at the state Supreme Court. And the state Supreme Court's been known to side with the Arizona State Legislature quite regularly. So I know there's members of the mayor and council. There's several of them who are concerned with this is going to bring a bill to Tucson that they can't afford. And that's going to, again, who's going to end up paying for that? It goes back to the taxpayer.
Well, they can also hide behind their charter city status to get away with it.
Yeah, absolutely. The next sections now, starting with Section 1 and 2, Section 1 and 2 attempt to expand the jurisdiction of the city court. Effectively, what it does is it says the city courts of Tucson will take on civil cases on behalf of those employees and the interested parties, which you can read as either unions or not-for-profit lawyers who do work supporting the employees, one of the two. Just because they're not-for-profit people, you've got to remember, they make money by arguing it.
Right.
So there is things that goes to their bank account. But he comes out and says that the claim of those acts and the relief of the damages and everything else is against the Arizona Constitution. He ultimately doesn't see how they can even put this in place. So if you don't think that's going to be argued in court, if they try to do it, it's going to be.
You know, it's so sad. I wish he would have came out with this opinion 3 months ago.
Well, like,
they had 27,000 people sign this piece of crap petition, right? And signed on basically a bunch of not-so-legal crap. I mean, it's amazing that we can even put that up there.
And that's the challenge of Citizens Initiatives. That's why there's so many people that are working against it. And I, for one, personally believe Citizens Initiatives are important. They're important for a state like Arizona, which it believes in independence and the individual. And we have to have a way of doing it. But because of the way we gather signatures and that's what puts it on the ballot, I guarantee there was nothing more said than, hey, do you believe in that everybody deserves to make $15? Yes, I do.
That's how it works.
Sign it. Nobody reads the 100 words. I think the legislature last year expanded it to 200. They just don't do it, so nobody is aware of any of this.
I also love that the food bank that put 50,000 towards shoving this down our throat, they had no one read this thing either, right? And go, there's some problems here, man.
You know, it is.
You know,
it's
sick.
And that is just sections 1 and 2 that deal with the city courts. And that's one, to be honest, we've known that the city attorney's been concerned about that for a while.
Sure.
Okay. But the fact of the matter, Chris, is you're not going to get it to the people collecting the signatures, and they're not going to explain it to the people that are out there. That's the job of running campaigns. The challenge is, this is another, to me, this is another citizens initiative with a name, Fight for 15, the minimum wage. That's not about that at all. It's about all the back end stuff.
So what percentage of our local media, other than what's going on this radio station, is going to cover that Mike Rankin has concerns?
Oh, I would hope the Arizona Daily Star will get that out there. I will hope the television stations get it out there. The Daily Star came out.
The Easter Bunny's coming to visit you tomorrow too, Ted. That'll be good.
The Daily Star came out and didn't support 206.
I'm going to tell you something. That was the worst. It sure sounded like they endorsed it without endorsing it.
It was very similar to what they did on their early childhood education lack of endorsement, which, by the way, was defeated. It was very similar to the Sanctuary City lack of endorsement. The concepts that people try to sell as the fronts for these initiatives are something the majority of us would probably get behind. But that's not what's in the initiative. It's the rest of the stuff. Section 3, which is the meat of the mission on what how they're going to create the new provisions of the city code. The first one we already talked about, the 5 hours of labor, and it defines hired by a hiring entity. Again, not an employer, a hiring entity. And those definitions are so narrow, they exempt the United States, the state government, the tribal entities, and a qualified market platform. So that's the ride sharing. They do exempt that. But the only thing you can hire without as an individual without falling under this guidelines and specifically states babysitting services. So that's the only thing. So if you can't have a babysitter call you on not treating them within these guidelines, but anybody else you hire could conceivably come back at you. The payment section then in this section.
So that means when I see the guy from Child and Family Services come out saying this is the greatest thing in the world, does he provide daycare as part of his business model, Family Child Services?
That's a good question, but if he provides babysitting, work.
That gets carved out, though?
The babysitting is the only one that you can hire a babysitter and not have them as an individual, as a hiring entity, and not have them come back and claim that you're paying it. But child services, if it's actually daycare facilities, you're under this law.
Oh, okay. So what you're saying is if I hire a guy to come over and cut my tree down, he's a babysitter that does pruning?
That you're going to have to be very careful on that one, Chris, no doubt. One of the next issues that's in conflict with federal and state law is there's a requirement in here that says you're not allowed to use certain forms of payment for employees who do not have a valid Social Security number. Well, here's the problem, as he points out in here, is it is federal law that all employees either have a Social Security number or apply for one within a short period of time. So I can make an argument that all you're basically doing by putting that in there on their part is you're just encouraging people who are going to take advantage of their employees. It's going to be a cash carry operation. They're not going to comply with any of this. And I don't think you're going to find any legitimate business owner putting somebody without a Social Security number on their payroll, because that would be illegal.
So this is very important, because to me, this thing was brought to you by the same people that brought you Sanctuary City.
And
this feels like backdoor Sanctuary City.
And my understanding was talking to the other folks who may not have been the writers of it, but who are supporters of it, they've kind of alluded to the fact that this was kind of a nod towards that. It is a little Sanctuary City issue because they wanted to mention to try to provide some protection for the undocumented workers. Oh, that's going to end up in court, because if you're a hiring entity that's hiring an undocumented worker, you're breaking federal law.
Don't I need an I-9 on somebody?
It would be bad. And this is the point. Poorly written, bad law. It's going to end up in court. It's going to be that you need to be no on 206.
Let's go right to the swamp. A man surviving out there, our friend of the show, Grover Norquist, Americans for Tax Reform. Grover, good morning.
Good to be with you.
So we were blessed last Thursday. Schweikert's picking up Mick Mulvaney from the airport. And they both called in for David Singh, so we got Mulvaney and Schweikert for a half hour of breaking things down on some of the nuttiness. But tell me about, just real quick, the Mitch McConnell extending the debt limit till December, Because, of course, a lot of conservatives out there said, again, he sold everyone down the toilet. And then I'm seeing some other things that said that was the right thing to do. What's your take on that?
Well, two things. Mitch McConnell is the smartest guy in the Senate, and he knows the rules, and he plays for the long term. So I generally would trust his judgment on when to move forward, when to move sideways. But we know from the reaction of the Democrats and Manchin that he was playing a very interesting game that he won, not lost. The Democrats were going to take this crisis, debt ceiling increase, to the very brink, to where you would actually default, in which then the world would go crazy and say you can't trust investing in American treasury bills anymore, and that would be not good. But they would do that in order to break the filibuster. They would bring you to this crisis on purpose, which is what they were walking into, and say, you know, the Republicans did this, which is what the establishment press was saying, even though, as Mitch McConnell pointed out, all the Democrats have to do is put it inside reconciliation. They can pass it anytime they want with 50 Democratic votes and the vice president. He said this 2-3 months ahead of time, and then the Democrats came up towards the finish line, and they said, oh, my goodness, we don't have the time to do this. Okay. And they were hoping to jam the two Democrats who were saying no, never, to ending the filibuster. And as Mitch McConnell is quite correct in understanding, the most important thing he can do in the next 2 years until we get the House and or the Senate back is stop the Democrats' drive to end the filibuster. If they end the filibuster, they will end right to work in all 50 states. I mean, these laws are already ready, and they've got the votes committed to them. They'll end right to work. They will ban independent contractors so that everybody has to work directly for a boss. So if you're, you know, delivering papers as an independent contractor or driving Uber or being a plumber or any of this stuff, you're going to be forced into working for a company so that you can be unionized. I mean, the number of things that the left planned, they'd nationalize all elections, and you'd no longer have voter ID, which the mass large majority of Americans of all racial backgrounds support voter ID, but the Democrats' law would ban it. So they would change the rules on everything so they would never lose an election in the next 20 or 30 years. And that has to be stopped. And the Democrats are going to use this as the crisis. Oh, just poke a hole in it once for this. And had Manchin or Sinema been forced into that, then the next time when they wanted to poke it to change labor law, or when they wanted to poke a hole in it to take over the country or to spend jillions of dollars in debt, what would stop it? And the good news is Schumer felt so beaten up that if he'd really thought he'd won, he'd have just moved forward. Instead, he gave this great speech, oh, we won. He backed down. And sitting behind him, you may have seen this shown on television.
I love this video, Grover. Keep going.
Yeah. Manchin's making faces and eventually getting up and leaving, and came up to him after, to Schumer. Manchin, who, you know, was part of whatever this agreement was with Sinema and the Republican leader to say, okay, we will give you we will not filibuster your effort to do this, but you'll have to provide all the votes to raise the debt ceiling, but we'll allow you to do that rather than filibuster it, but we will never do this again. And the unspoken apparent deal here is Manchin and Sinema have both told the Democratic leadership, in December or January, when this comes up again, you have to do it the other way. This will not be done again. This will never be used as an example of why you have to get rid of the filibuster, and we're telling you that now, okay? Now. So don't play this game a second time. That actually is a huge win, because Schumer slapped Manchin and Sinema in the face, lied to the whole country about what was going on. Now, maybe they fool a lot of people, because ABC doesn't exactly, you know, give you the news as it happens. 100 senators know what happened, and that's the audience for this one. Schumer lied. Mitch McConnell, they got what he wanted, and Manchin and Sinema didn't get rolled over. They didn't get rolled over. And Manchin went up to Schumer afterwards and, in rather coarse language, said, you really screwed up. But there was a swear word in there.
Correct. Even Chris Coons from Delaware came out and said, I don't know what Schumer thought he was doing by doing this.
He I mean, this is not the first time Schumer has done this to Manchin. Schumer allowed all the Democrats to go out and say, Manchin won't tell us what he wants, and he's no good, and Sinema won't say what she wants. And then Manchin leaked the memo, handed out to people. It's a one-page memo. Months ago, he said, these are the things that I have to have, okay? That I won't vote for if it's more than $1.5 trillion, and I won't vote for it if you don't have the Hyde Amendment in there. I mean, there's a series of very serious restrictions in there that Schumer has known for months. Now, did he lie to the other senators and not tell them about the memo? He signed it, and he felt it was an important enough thing because he wrote on the bottom, I'm going to try and change Manchin's mind on this, okay? So that, you know, if you showed it to some other Democrat, it wouldn't look like he'd agreed to Manchin's demands, but or conceded to them. But he knew what they were, where the lines in the sand were. So he goes to the press and allows all the Democrats to lie about Manchin and Sinema, like they won't tell you what they want. They've been very clear. Sinema says, don't raise the business taxes, don't raise individual taxes. This is not the time to raise taxes. We're still in the middle of a pandemic, and the economy is not growing the way it should be. Don't raise taxes. Okay. If you don't raise taxes, then you can't spend as much money as you've been planning. Sinema and Manchin are both very clear what they want. Manchin doesn't like discriminating against real energy as opposed to fake energy and subsidizing the make-believe energy and taxing real energy, which most of the Democrats want to move to an imaginary energy zone that costs a lot more money and has to be subsidized by taxes on you and me and higher prices, which is why people generally don't use make-believe energy because it costs more than it produces in energy.
I just like the term make-believe energy, but just keep going.
Yeah, so it's just, everything's energy. Bananas are energy if you burn them at the right temperature, I suppose. It's just expensive.
Is that potential energy? I'm trying to remember. Is that potential energy?
Potential. Yes, there's lots of potential energy. The snapping your fingers and shuffling across the carpet and then hitting your TV to make it play for a couple seconds. Lots of things do create energy. It's just not cost efficient to do it that way. I think that be careful. If anyone tells you that Mitch McConnell got played, it's not impossible, okay? But it is not the way you bet. And so it pays to sit back and take a look at what happens. We never know what happens inside the Democratic meetings. But when they come out of the meetings and their reaction to what happened in them gives you some sense. Remember when the Democrats, it was starting to be said that Democrats are all in tumult and they're not agreeing. And then the Democrat leading the Ways and Means Committee, the Tax Committee in the House, and the Finance Committee, which does taxes and Senate, we've come to an agreement. And that made the headlines, Democrats come to agreement. No, two guys came to the following agreement. We have a list of different tax increases, okay? Neither the House or the Senate agree on which tax increases, but we agree that the tax increases we have, whatever they are, however many or few there are, will be from this list. That was the agreement of two people. But that made headlines. So if that was the best you could do to show agreement, when you realize what you just seen was no agreement to anything by anybody, because even the two guys didn't agree to a list of taxes. The reason why there are two lists put together is that they don't agree on those. So when they tell you everything's cool, we have this agreement, that's when you realize how bad it must be, because they won't tell you how bad it is, or how unpopular is the spend-a-thon Biden has. Well, his advertisement for in the last 2-3 weeks has been, it doesn't cost anything.
Yeah, I know.
If someone tried to sell you a car, they tell you it drives fast, it does this, it's pretty, they sell you the attributes of the car or the banana or whatever they're selling you. It's free. It's what you get for stuff you don't want. It's free. Why do you have to say it's free if it's so appetizing? If it's such a good idea, you would say, isn't this great?
So my last question for you is, what's the purpose here, really, in the end for the Democrats, right? We have this basically a fool of a puppet that says he's the president running around looking for ice cream, right? We have, they're poking every part of the American population in the eye with the stick, right? What's the purpose in the end? Just to slam a whole bunch of, just yank us to the left so hard that when they lose everything again, we're stuck with it because we usually can't find the will when we control things to reverse these things. What's the purpose?
Yes, it is to create programs that they believe will be so popular you can't undo them. And that they would think will be so expensive and taxes that will somehow be difficult to cut. They want to change the reality, the facts on the ground to buy themselves the next election. They realize that they think that they're going to lose the House and the Senate. Polling by Democratic staffers thinks they'll lose the House and the Senate. The British, which let you bet on these things, are betting now that the Republicans win the Senate as well as the House of Representatives. But they want to change they mostly want to change the rules. They would rather change labor law and election law than the spending stuff. But given reconciliation, you can change the tax and spending. You can't change laws. As long as we keep the filibuster in place, they can't change the laws that would make it impossible to win an election anytime soon. But they're hoping to buy enough votes. That's their plan. They think this stuff is more popular than it is. But also, when you throw $1, $2, $3 trillion, $5 trillion out there, and then in it you require people to join unions to get the money, which is in most of these rules, and then the unions take $1,000 dues, and then they kick that back to the Democratic Party, you can fund the next election with taxpayer dollars recycled through union dues into Washington, and with their billionaire friends who are getting massive subsidies for green energy stuff, they're kicking back contributions. So they hope to buy the next election with all this spending. And if they can't do that, the problem is they lose the House and Senate, the bleeding stops. Just like 2 years of Clinton, people said Republican House and Senate, hadn't done that for 62 years. And then 2 years into Obama, House lost, Senate 6 seats down. That's likely to happen this time, one or both of those houses, and then they can't pass anything through that.
Well, it's in our ballpark not to screw it up, Grover. So,
yes, and that's what we need to compromise. That's what we need to focus on, and that means nominating people who can win and helping to fund people who can win and people who are principled. And when they show up, unlike John McCain, will remember to vote with us. We were inches away from getting rid of Obamacare.
I remember
block granting Medicaid to the states, which would have allowed grown-up states to do some very interesting things and the crazy states to bankrupt themselves.
All right, check out ATR.org, of course, for everything that they're working at in Americans for Tax Reforms. Grover, I always appreciate the conversation, sir. Have a good day.
You got it. Thank you.
All right, Grover Norquist, Americans for Tax Reform. When you hear our friend Marty Robbins, that means our other friend Dan Shearer is calling up from the Valley of Greenness. Dan, welcome aboard, sir. Let's get to Huckleberry sends
and so here's how
look at me
work.
Being nicer than you.
I imagine that. Well, I read the memo, and I've read more than just the memo too. And so, you know, Matt Hines actually floated this idea in a supervisor meeting not long ago, where he basically said, "I don't understand what constables do. Let's just get rid of them," because you know that's what we should do when we don't understand things—not try to understand them, but actually just get rid of them. So, this apparently Huckleberry has taken this idea and run with it, though I suspect he has thought about it in the past. So here's how things are. We have 10 justice courts, and they handle the low-level stuff, you know, traffic fines and shoplifting, and they do things like, you know, subpoenas and injunctions against harassment, you know, orders of protection and whatever. So the judge makes a decision, and then for each of those 10 courts, there is one constable for each court. So the constables, the judge makes the decision, the constable carries out the will of the court, which often means delivering paperwork, and that roughly is what a constable does. So what they, if you go look at this system, he lays out in his memo that it's really broken, and he is correct, and here's the reason. Constables are elected, meaning that they have an oversight board on the state level, but pretty much their boss is you and me, the voter. And so the problem is that they aren't really collaborating well. Some are doing a lot more work than others, and they have different philosophies. This is key. They have different philosophies on how things should be carried out. And I'll give you an example of that. We currently have one constable who is suspended until the end of the year. Why? Well, because when he went to go evict somebody from a property, he told them, you know what, you can have a little bit of extra time. I'll help you find a place, and everything will be nice. Well, everything's nice except for the property owner who's been trying to get that deadbeat out of there for quite a while. And remember, if you're being tossed off your property, you're being evicted, you've been told multiple times.
Well, it's a public record. Who's the constable?
Let me get his name. I will get his name.
Okay.
It's in our story. It's in our story.
All right. I'll look it up.
Yeah. Yeah. So he's dumped until suspended until the end of the year. But again, this is the philosophy. Some of them say, look, I'm going to go in there and I'm going to vacate the property. That's my job. Okay. As a constable. Others are like, you know, let's bring in some social services. Let's make sure that they know what's available to them. I'm all for that, by the way, until you get to that final point. How many chances are you going to give somebody? Again, by the time the constable shows up to get your stuff out of the house, you have been warned many, many times. And so this is where the philosophical difference is. Here's what I think is going on, is that what Pima County wants to do is to get rid of all of the constables and replace them with county workers who now they can manage much more tightly. And that's exactly what would happen. One, they would pay them a lot less. A constable, the top end, and all of them are getting it, is $67,000 a year. They would bump them down. But the more important thing is that Pima County now could, in essence, inject its philosophy into a lot of these decisions on how the court's paperwork is carried out. They shouldn't be allowed to, because when the court makes a decision, it makes a decision. The order of protection, whatever, the eviction, the warrant, the order of protection, whatever, the eviction, you just do it. But there is some wiggle room in there, and that's what we've been seeing. So this is my suspicion. But I will say this, the memo does paint a picture of this constable system really being unorganized, chaotic, a lot of infighting, and it is accurate. That is accurate.
We've Oscar, known that for a Matt, while. Matt found that Oscar Vasquez.
Yeah, Oscar Vasquez. Yeah, that's right.
So because we hang out with McCluskey, and he has 900 rentals and 900 to 1,000 rentals he has to manage, he's run into, I don't guess Vasquez is a problem, but of course the one who's buddies with all the Democrats is Kristen Randall, right?
Well, she's
the one who doesn't want to evict people either.
Well, but I liked what she did, where she instituted this program that that when someone is initially targeted for eviction, they do get in there with some services and let them know, look, here are your options. I'm all for that. But that is as the process is working its way through, because there are a lot of people out there who just don't know that, yeah, there is help available. But in the end, when it's like, okay, it's moving day, you have to stop it at that point. I think Kristen Randall does understand that, but here's
Sean talks about how she doesn't show up for, like, she's supposed to be there. I think it's her. Hey, they do that, and they don't show up, or they're amazing. Yeah. Like, they don't, you know, like, they're the ones who are really late. Oh, I'm sorry you didn't wait an hour, you know? The lack of professionalism is...
Well, and they're not accountable to anybody. And you hit on another one of the problems. And the problem is that, let's say, Kristen has a certain philosophy on evictions, and she's on vacation, or she's overwhelmed with other work. She doesn't want one of the hard-nosed constables
to be
delivering her papers. And so it will stack up or back up or whatever until she can find someone. She doesn't. That's where the collaboration problem is. And so it's really interesting, because for those of us on the outside, we look at it and we say, the judge tells you to do something, you do something. What's so hard about that? Well, again, there's that wiggle room. And then ultimately, and as Chuck has identified, they answer to the voter. If we don't like it, we can vote them out next time. Now, you tell me, what is farther down and more gets less thought on a ballot than a constable?
Well, again, it's really like it's a six or half dozen, because working for Huckleberry, there's no justice either, okay? All right? I mean, the guy runs the most inefficient bureaucracy in the southwestern United States.
Well, I'll tell you this.
Well, sorry, city of Tucson.
Something has to be done. but I don't know that this is the answer to it. It's a big move, and now so where all of this stands right now, and of course remember, Huckleberry comes up with the idea, but the Board of Supervisors actually makes the decision. So he's not deciding this. This isn't happening. This is just a memo saying, hey, here's what we're thinking. In the memo is a review by Mark Napier, who now is now an assistant county manager, and he's the one who kind of dug into this whole thing and said, okay, here's what the problem is, and here's how we might want to handle it. But number one is that they have to go to County Attorney Laura Conover and say, look, can we just go in and decide that we're not going to have constables anymore, get rid of this elected office? Obviously, you have to allow everybody to work out their terms who are elected to those. So this is still,
well, the other thing is, if you're Kristen Randall, who's the darling of the left, right, in the PMIC Democrat Party, right, can she convince three votes not to go with this? And that's possible, too.
Yeah, I guess.
Because I'm sure she loves being rubber stamped into this job. And that, would you rather be rubber stamped by an election that no one really cares about, but they'll just keep voting in, or actually work for Huckleberry? I mean, for Huckleberry, I'd rather shove bamboo shoots underneath my fingernails.
Well, there is a presiding constable, can't remember his name either, and I don't think he's actually in our story.
Stevenson.
Pertinent. Yeah, Stevenson. Okay, so he has tried to fix this, and that's in the memo also. He has tried to fix this, and by the way, we have attached the memo to our story. He's tried to fix this, and Napier just says it's just too little too late. And so they would not even listen to the guy within their own ranks who was trying to corral them and basically hold off the county from making a decision like this. And so it's really bad, and really it's funny how Napier sets it up. He says, you know, I have the real rigid constable, who a lot of them are former law enforcement, then you have those who dress like urban social workers, is the way that he worded it. It's kind of funny in that memo.
That's so perfect.
It is. It's really got some very telling things, particularly for those of us who have known that there has been a big problem in there for the last couple of years.
Before we go to break, it also warmed the cockles of my heart in the third sentence of Napier's memo. Thank Jesus they submitted the memo to Nicole Fife and, oh, Lisa Royal. She's still around.
Yeah, exactly.
Thank Jesus.
The gift that keeps giving. Yeah.
We have our friend, President and CEO of Solidarity HealthShare. Brad, welcome to the show.
You know, there was an article in the Wall Street Journal yesterday, and last week, I think Fox News picked up on it. You know, Merck and Ridgeback Biotherapeutics are supposed to have this, you know, new drug that they're going to put out that's supposed to, you know, really cut back on the COVID, you know, severity of it. Right. But also, too, is supposed to come back and shorten the days, you know, and stuff like that. So we did a little poking around on this. And first of all, this new wonder drug by Merck, the Department of Defense put in $10 million in the funding of this drug. The National Institutes of Health put in another $19 million. And then just this in June, the government just signed a $1.2 billion contract with Merck to provide these pills, you know, to counter, you know, to counter the COVID virus. And it's estimated that by the end of the year, you know, Merck's going to make about $7 billion off of this product because they're, you know, they're going to try to give it away for free. So the kicker is this. Number one is, there's a couple kickers here. The first one, it's going to cost about $17.74 to produce, and the government purchased it for $712. Forty times the amount. So let me get this right. So we had the federal government, our taxpayer dollars, through the Department of Defense, the National Institutes of Health, you know, funded to produce this drug. And by the way, this drug was initially set up to treat horse encephalitis. That's the first thing it was used for. And now they're going to switch it over to COVID. And so the government's going to pay 40 times the amount for it. And you ready for the next thing? I had my doctors look at this. This new drug has similar mechanism of action. I guess that's a term you use when you have drugs and pharmaceuticals. A similar mechanism of action.
The old we call that the old MOA, but keep going.
Yeah. The same similar mechanism of action as ivermectin. It's basically ivermectin repackaged. And so they picked up $29 million of federal funding on this. And now they're going to sell it back to the government for 40 times the price. And it's basically ivermectin. You know, it's not exactly the same, but it's the same mechanism of delivery, and it's going to treat the virus exactly the same way as ivermectin. And so now it makes sense why everybody was,
crapping on ivermectin.
Yeah, because they got a new drug that they can make another $7 billion off of this year.
The man who coined money, power, vanity, but mostly it's about the money, a little big money by the Rush Kids, Congressman David Schweikert. Welcome back.
Hi there.
Hi there.
You know, I just emailed you an article you'll get a kick out of, showing that this year and it looks like the coming few years, air quality is going to actually get dirtier because of the Biden policies. And it's just one of those classic cases. We could see it coming. So, you know, the attack on natural gas, not allowing pipelines, not permitting this, not permitting that, no more exploration on public lands. Okay. So lots of power facilities around the country are converting back to coal. So air quality, so greenhouse gases went down fairly dramatically during the Trump administration.
We didn't join the Paris Accords. How can that happen?
But so now we have a global warming, worried climate change president, and the policies have been so screwed up that now we're in panic. We're asking other parts of the world to produce more hydrocarbons and fashions that will leak lots of methane and other things, but we're having now go back to lots of coal in the United States because we didn't keep up. It's a comedy of errors. If you lay out what the left says their goal is and then what they accomplish, you and I have talked over and over that working class Americans and the working poor will be poor at the end of this year because of Democrat policies. When you take inflation and add it to even the wage hikes that are going on, we're all falling further and further behind every single day. I just can't figure out why voters go back to this clown show. It seems like every 30, 40 years, it sounds good, except it destroys people's lives. Unless, of course, you're part of the 1% of politicians and bureaucrats that gain lots of power.
You're one of those cats that read a little deeper into budgets and polls and stuff like that. Let's go into the poll part. What are we seeing out there? What are some of these Democrats seeing when it comes to this pathetic infrastructure bill? Are you seeing that basically? What they're seeing is maybe the voters that really don't dig this stuff. What are we seeing in those kind of numbers out there, Dave?
Well, the problem is it's their marginal voters. And look, we often have trouble with our base understanding. It's if you're a Republican activist, you're voting for the Republicans. If you're a Democrat activist, you're voting for the Democrats. It's that family across the street that's just trying to raise their kids, trying to keep their job, trying to keep some sanity, who just, they don't care about politics. And what the Democrats are seeing is those folks who are much more independent-minded don't like what they're seeing. Their gas is more expensive. Their protein is more expensive. They see their little kids go off having to wear a mask in school. They're not happy. And they may not have liked President Trump, but they thought they were getting something very different. They thought we were going to get this sort of, remember, the normalities coming back.
Right.
This isn't normal.
The
late 1970s is your utopia.
So remember they said in the 2020 election about the suburban mom vote, right?
Oh, yeah.
Hasn't the Democrats just crapped on the suburban moms of the last 8 years, 8 months?
We're starting to see that breakthrough. What's really interesting, and it's too early to have really good numbers yet, but one of the miracles of the last election, and this is really panicking the Democrats, is the number of Hispanics, particularly Hispanic men, who voted for Republicans.
Right.
I know in my own polling, I won Hispanic men. and I'm a pretty conservative guy. And it turns out that population just wanted to work. They wanted,
right.
They saw the world through more of a lens of economics. But we had real trouble, particularly if you were unmarried, female, in a suburb. Republicans didn't do well with you. And some of that was they just were offended by some of the antics of the previous president. And so it was a vote on their feeling, which, you have to respect. I mean, voters all come to the polling place with different reasons.
Yep.
But they haven't gotten that satiation of warm, comfortable normality. What they see happening on the border, what they see happening, to their own families, to their cost of living.
I feel like 90% of the videos I see of pissed off people yelling at their school board, it's suburban moms.
It is. Now, we still have to understand, why are the Democrats, so many of them, pushing so hard for that massive spending bill? Their theory is, you can be mad at me all you want, but I'm going to be sending you a check every month.
Right.
And they intend to buy the complicity of the voters. Remember, some of those checks go to families making $200, $225. You can make $800,000 and get all sorts of subsidies. I mean, we did calculation the other day. It's like $118,000 in direct cash subsidies if you buy the right solar panels and the right car and those sorts of things. So even the upper income, they're trying to buy their love.
Well,
so it's interesting. They've decided they're not going to win by policy. They're going to win by bribery.
Cecily, good morning. You're on the Wake Up Tucson show. How are you?
Hi, good. How are you?
Not too bad. We've had you guys on before in the Atlas Obscuro world. So we're foodies on the show. So when I saw there was a food adventurer's guide written by you and Dylan, I was an automatic yes to get you on the show. So welcome to the Wake Up Tucson show.
Awesome. Thanks so much. Happy to be here.
Tell me about Cecily's journey to get to write the food adventurer's guide about the entire planet.
I know. It's been quite the endeavor. It's been 4 years. We've been working on this for a long time. And it's Dylan and I, but we also have, we have a whole Gastro Obscura team that's been helping us behind the scenes. And then we have, you're familiar with Atlas Obscura. We have a lot of users around the world who write in and give us tips about foods we should check out. So we got a lot of stuff from that too.
So when you guys started doing this for the first time, how do you guys mentally break it down on how to, put it all together, and then you got to prioritize. So what was the criteria for prioritizing what you talked about and included in the book?
Sure. So we just moved continent by continent, and within those continents, we went country by country. We tried to just, kind of fill it systematically, and we were mainly looking for stories. We're focusing on foods with really incredible histories or stories behind them. And then just wacky things, eccentric foods, things that people are doing with foods, festivals, histories. And so we started there, and we did kind of a full pass of the world, and then we'd come back, look in the holes, try and fill the gaps, reach out to people we knew in different countries, and we pieced it together.
Give me one or two of your favorite spots in the world that you discovered through doing this book and that experience.
Sure. So there's a marathon in France in the Medoc wine region. It is called the Marathon du Medoc.
I just love that there's a food experience in France that has a marathon, but just...
Exactly. Well, it's a very, I don't know if we'd call it a French marathon, but it could only happen in France in that you stop 23 times to drink wine. You have 23 glasses of wine along the marathon. Then you also, stop to eat foie gras, you eat oysters, you have some ice cream, and you're running through, vineyards, chateaus, there's lakes, like it's really gorgeous and people are wearing costumes. But it's, it is, 23 glasses of wine is no joke, especially over 26 miles.
Ay, Chihuahua. The I have a friend of mine who's a hotelier, but he's from France, and he always talks about how sometimes the French can be difficult. He says he has a great line. He goes, "We have 314 different kinds of cheeses. Trust me, we're a pain in the butt." So, so I'm looking. I look through the book for, you know, I got to do a little home team action here. And whenever the next edition is, you got to come see us because we got to do better in Arizona than the Organ Stop Pizza in Mesa. I know it's got the cool organ.
It does. It has the cool organ. Well, tell me, what should be in the book?
You should go see Don Guetta, who basically uses this. He uses these more older, ancient, original grains at a place called Barrio Bread. That's where I would start off first. And he's literally brought back. What were you going to say, Cecily?
I think that might be on the website.
Ah, excellent. So anyway.
Which is great, yeah.
So you guys got to come out to Tucson. We got a variety of things to share with you that the organ's cute, but we got to do better than that. Just got to be a snob that way.
Yeah,
sorry.
No, I would love to. that's you know, it's not the organ, the Organ Stop is not exactly about the pizza. It's more about the organ. So I absolutely believe that there are better things to eat in Arizona.
Let's talk about how does this. I mean, to me, you've already laid out a groundwork for the most kick butt TV show humanly possible. When do you guys do a TV show on this? I mean, of all the bad shows about food out there, I mean, you guys have written the.
I know
you got 12 seasons here.
I think so, at least. I mean, as soon as they sign me up to, you know, host it and travel to all these places, I think we're ready to do it.
PBS is swimming with money. We got to hook you guys up with PBS. You could be the Rick Steves of food. That's what I would do.
challenge accepted. I'm ready and down to do it.
I love it. Let's talk
Tucson
about
Tucson will be our first stop.
You better believe it. I like some of your surprising facts. So it's funny. So you say Norway has the highest per capita pizza consumption, and it's really funny you say that. So when I watch some of these shows from Scandinavia that are filmed in Scandinavia, they all do seem like they're having pizza. So you verified something just for me watching Scandinavian television shows.
That's so funny. Yeah, no, they eat the most pizza per capita in the world. It's not something anyone would guess. They eat 50 million pizzas every year. And the craziest side of this fact is that 47 million of them are frozen. And so they're eating mostly frozen pizza. They have a deep, deep love for frozen pizza. The classic Norwegian pizza is it's tomato sauce, Jarlsberg cheese, and paprika. And then you add extra cheese and bake it. And then when it comes out, you drizzle it with ketchup.
That does, you know, I have my feeling of Scandinavian hygge, and that's just not the picture. That's just not the picture I'm seeing, Cecily.
Not for you. Yeah, no, the ketchup has not been getting great reactions, but, you know, to each their own.
And then I do like this one of your fun facts. The Soviets paid Pepsi in warships in 1989. Please explain that story because I think that's fascinating.
They did. You know, classic Americans. Pepsi really wanted to enter this untapped market. There was no Pepsi in the Soviet Union, but they couldn't get paid in rubles. They were kind of worthless outside of the Soviet Union, and so they had to barter. And so Pepsi gave them Pepsi, and in return we got warships. We became the middleman for all these warships that we sold, and that's how Pepsi got paid.
Now, I like in the story, originally, what did they originally trade for? Is it actually even funner?
Vodka.
So they were trading Pepsi for Stoli.
yes, they were, which is actually, that seems like a more fair trade. You're right.
So for people who get this book, Cecily, and the book, of course, is Gastro Obscura, I'm sure you can get it at the Evil Empire of Amazon and fine bookstores, as we like to say. What do you want people to get out of this thing?
It's honestly, it's just a lot of fun. You dip in and out. There's something kind of, you know, eccentric and wild on every single page. And I hope that I hope that you gain a bunch of wacky food knowledge that you can share at your next dinner party, and also have a huge list of places you want to go as soon as we're allowed to go again.
You know, when I was looking at your bio, I noticed you're more of a novelist. is your thing.
I am primarily a novelist.
So how did the novelist get sucked into this thing?
I write fiction, but I grew up in a food family. My parents own restaurants. I'm a very enthusiastic eater. I travel for pretty much the sheer purpose of eating. And so when they launched Gastro Obscura, that was my interest. But they were also looking to do kind of a more narrative side of food. They wanted to look at the stories and the histories. And so I was kind of an interesting choice, but it all worked out. And we're just kind of approaching food through a novelist's eyes. So lots and lots of good stories in this book.
What's the next project?
I have a novel coming out next summer. It's called Kaleidoscope. It's a family story. It's about sisterhood and ambition and self-knowledge. It takes you around the world. There's lots of food. It's different from this book, but I hope equally good.
So people who come on this show who are from Tucson, we always ask them, even if it has nothing to do with food as their profession, we always ask them their favorite two locally owned restaurants. So I see you're a Portland girl, so give me the two best locally owned restaurants for Cecily Wong if we come visit Portland.
This one's tough. Okay, I'm going to go with Grind with Tries, which is a plate lunch restaurant, Hawaiian plate lunch.
Oh, okay.
Really, really excellent. Line around the block every single day.
Very nice. And what's the go-to for you there?
I eat the pokey, which is the, and then I eat everything. They have an amazing garlic shrimp. They have Korean short ribs. They
Beautiful.
Have meat jeon, which is also a Korean dish. Yeah, it's fantastic.
And what's number two?
And then there's a food cart called Bing Me. And it's Chinese Bing, Jian Bing, and it's kind of this crepe type, this huge crepe that they fold up. There's an egg, there's lots of sauces, lots of herbs, you can put duck in it, and they wrap it up. It's a street food from China. It's the best version that I've had stateside. It's fantastic.
Wow. I'm going to have to figure out how to make that at home. That just sounds amazing.
If you figure out how to make that at home, I will be very impressed.
I will let you know. Oh, well, congratulations on the book. I've been reading it off and on since it was sent to me the last couple of weeks, and it's a fun read, man, and you will learn a lot, and you always learn a lot through people's food, and again, we're going to have you come back for second edition. You tell me when you're ready to come to Tucson, and we will introduce you to everything you need to do for second edition.
I will let you know. I will hit you up as soon as we are renovating the book.
Awesome. All right. Well, congratulations. Nice talking to you, Cecily.
Thanks so much. You too.
You take care. Cecily Wong, novelist and co-author of Gastro Obscura, A Food Adventurer's Guide.